A genius musician called Blind Tom was one of the biggest stars of the American music hall era. Blind Tom could play three songs at once on the piano. He could imitate the rain and the thunder. He could recite Plato in Greek. And he was born in the South, a slave. My guest today, Jeffrey Renard Allen, was born in Chicago. Jeffrey's family is also from the South, and he has written an astonishing novel about Blind Tom's life. Welcome to Conversations, Jeffrey.
I'm honored to be here. Thank you.
Jeffrey, you were born in Chicago, but whereabouts was your mum from?
My mom was born in 1930 in segregated Mississippi. So she was born in a small town called Houston, which is near the town of Tupelo. That's probably most famous because it was the birthplace of Elvis Presley. But that general area is in the Mississippi Delta, not all that far from the University of Mississippi.
What sort of education did she get?
My mom was fortunate in that she received a high school education. So my mother's mother, my maternal grandmother, like the other women in the family on my mom's side, my maternal grandmother worked as a domestic, primarily working in the homes of wealthy white people in Mississippi. But the great thing is that my grandmother was able to find a way to send my mom to a private Catholic school in Memphis. So my mom left Mississippi and went to school in Memphis and finished her schooling there. And then, like a lot of other African Americans in the years after the Second World War, she began to consider her prospects for a better life. And I believe most people then thought that it would be better to go north. So my great aunt Beulah, my mom's aunt, came to Chicago in the late 40s, and then my mom came to Chicago soon after.
That was a part of a great migration indeed. Of African Americans moving north.
That's right, indeed, yes.
And what sort of prospects were there for her once she arrived in Chicago?
From what I know, from what my mom has told me and what I know, she worked a number of jobs at retail stores. But eventually she settled into the work of being a domestic herself, as, you know, like the other women in the family. She worked for wealthy white families in Chicago.
How about your dad, Jeffrey? Did your mom and dad meet in Chicago?
Yes, they did meet in Chicago. So my father was born and raised in Chicago, unlike my mom. And for that reason, I think my father was also more kind of street savvy person and had a very different personality. And so they married in the 1950s. My father was in the Army for a time, you know, but he never was in combat or anything like that. And he had other kinds of jobs and so on. But my mom and my father separated when I was about 2 years old. So I had very little contact with him. And also the, you know, getting the story of what caused their separation was always a difficult one. But ultimately what I found out is that my father basically, you know, kind of opted for a criminal lifestyle that my mother wasn't willing to be privy to. So they separated. So I was then raised by her, essentially.
It sounds quite isolated as a sort of family, Jeffrey, if your mum's family is from the South and then yeah. It's just you and her in Chicago. Was it a fairly tight unit, just the two of you?
It was fairly tight, but the other thing is that my aunt was also in Chicago. She came up at a certain point. She's my mom's younger sister. But it was still a small family. It was basically myself and my mom, my aunt, and her three kids. And the other thing is that every summer, you know, we all went to spend time with my grandmother in the South. By that point, my grandmother had moved to West Memphis, Arkansas, on the other side of the Mississippi River. So my first cousins and I spent pretty much every summer there, which gave us a different perspective, I think, from what we saw in Chicago.
What was the contrast between the life that you lived there and regular life in Chicago?
You know, essentially, of course, Chicago was a big city and West Memphis, Arkansas was a small town. So, you know, we rode our bikes and did the usual things and drank tea and lemonade that my grandmother made. But there are also certain kinds of ugly realities that we became aware of, too, on our travels there. So, for example, I can remember coming through Jackson, Mississippi, you know, as a kid, and you could actually see the local chapter of the Ku Klux Klan. The headquarters was like right downtown.
Wow, what, so, like with the sign out the front?
Yeah, or? It was there. So, you know, that was an awareness. And there's also a certain kind of awareness of how my grandmother interacted with the white people that she encountered and the way that she talked about them. And that was really, I think, pretty typical of her having grown up in the segregated South, where you were expected to defer to white people and that kind of thing.
So that's what you'd observe of the way she'd just speak differently.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, even my grandmother, you know, she would tell me things like, oh, you know, why don't you straighten your hair like those good white boys that work for and these kinds of things. So it was a very kind of conflicted relationship with her, and one that's really stayed with me in the sense that once we all arrived there at her home, she was very friendly towards us and so happy to have us there. But then she very soon became sort of angry and bitter about us being there, and I never quite understood the source of her unhappiness, really. But a lot of it had to do with her own frustrations and expectations. And in the course of time, you know, my grandmother died when I was about 17, but she came up to visit my mom and I during that period in Chicago when she was sick with cancer, and she observed some trophies that won playing chess. You know, I played chess in high school, and so she observed these trophies and she started crying, and she was so proud. You know, it was really kind of a mind-blowing experience, because I didn't think much about the trophies, but it meant a tremendous something tremendous to her, and knowing that our lives were taking a path that she herself was never able to have.
Jeffrey, you mentioned that your mum in Chicago worked as a domestic cleaning other people's houses. Did you ever go with her?
Yes. I mean, I actually accompanied her quite regularly, primarily when I you know, on days when I didn't have school or perhaps on holidays. And so, you know, that was a transformative thing, too, in its own way. So, for example, there was a family that my mom worked for in the suburb of Winnetka in the north of Chicago. And, you know, we lived in fairly modest surroundings in Chicago. I you know, I wouldn't call it a ghetto, really, but we lived in this neighborhood called South Shore. It was primarily working class and the working poor, a courtyard building. It was clean and well kept and all of that, but it was very modest. But then we would, you know, I would go with my mom to Winnetka, to this house where she worked, and it was kind of a modest house in its own way, but it was certainly the house was lavish in comparison to our own surroundings, and you know, it had a large kitchen. There was a beautiful den, and it was surrounded by this beautiful yard. There was a piano in the den and a fireplace and these wonderful bedrooms upstairs. And so I really, you know, my mom would go there to work, and sometimes I helped her do this or that and anything that she wanted me to do. But I also would just sit there and spend time reading on the patio or playing in the yard, or sitting at the piano and messing around with the keys on the piano. But the other thing that happened is when I returned home to Chicago, where we lived, at night before I went to sleep, I would begin to imagine these stories about a family living in that same house in Winnetka, but it was a black family. And every night I would sort of create an episode about this family in my own mind. And I realized later, and really I realized this only quite recently, that I think that's really where I began to become a fiction writer, a storyteller myself, you know, by imagining this situation with the black family.
Yeah, were they happy in that house, that black family?
They were happy, but they had various conflicts. I don't remember anymore all the stories that I created, but it was a form of a, you know, it was a way of expressing a certain longing that I had for a better life, but it was also a way of exercising my imagination towards that end, to achieving something better beyond the limitations of segregated Chicago.
Did you interact? Would you speak with the owners? Were they there when your mum and you would go to clean?
Oh, yes. I mean, I would say in all fairness that they were quite nice people. You know, I played with their kids. There was one kid who was roughly my age. I think he might be a year younger. And, you know, and there were other kids. And I was privy to their troubles and also their successes. And I think they saw my mom as a member of the family. And so when there were times when, you know, she had, let's say, money troubles or whatever, and they would help in whatever way they can. But I also do feel that they had their own limitations. I mean, you know, that is to say that they were, you know, liberals, and I would not call them by any means racist, but I do think that they might have done other things to help my mom in my own situation, you know, and her, given that she was the only one raising me. And I don't, and my mom was very proud, and, you know, still is to this day, and she's not the kind of person that would ever ask for anything. But, you know, the salary that she earned working as a domestic was not enough to keep us living well. So that is to say, my mom received public assistance, you know, money from the government. And if we had not received that money, we would have been living in really shabby surroundings in quite terrible conditions. So I think that was the other reality that this family didn't see.
It's that thing, isn't it? In America, those of us on the outside can imagine it's mainly, the divisions are mainly about race, but class is such a big part of the story you're telling.
Right. I heard someone say once that, you know, in England, everyone talks about class and no one talks about race. And in America, everyone talks about race and no one talks about class. And I suspect in Australia, it's probably a similar kind of situation where everyone talks about race and not class. But yeah, I mean, I think that's one of the deep realities of American society is there's a certain kind of mythology about success and about everyone's ability to become successful. And it's, you know, it's based on this idea that we all have the same opportunities and all start on an even playing field. And it's anything but the case. I mean, you know, the realities are, you know, there are all kinds of educational inequalities in America. And, you know, I had fairly poor schooling when I really think about it, but I was fortunate enough to have teachers who cared about me. But, you know, the case in America so much is one where the best schools are in the neighborhoods that have the highest property value. And so, you know, that's one of the problems. And, you know, it was also a kind of interesting phenomenon, too. I mean, in terms of this, you know, what I observed as a kid growing up and as a teenager and so on, there was always this constant mythology of selling race as a question of impoverishment in America, you know. So, for example, a very common thing was to, if one of the major news stations did a program about race and poverty, or if they did a program about poverty, what they would typically do is to profile an African-American family, a black family. And the reality is that, you know, there are far more poor people, poor white people in America than there are black. There are far more poor white people who are on welfare, on government assistance, than there are black people. But the mythology was one of selling this story that, oh, you know, all black people are poor and all black people are relying on the government, you know. And so that's one of how class and race interacts in just one example in America.
In your own life as you were growing up, Jeffrey, did you have any models of black families who were succeeding professionally that you kind of aspired to? Was that in your circle?
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the great things about the neighborhood where I did grow up in South Shore. I mean, as I say, most of us didn't have much, but, you know, I was in some ways alone in that a lot of the other kids I knew had fathers who went out to work. You know, it was just me and my mom. But, you know, my mom had one of her best friends live right downstairs under us. And that woman was married to a mechanic, you know, and so she stayed home, but he went out to work every day. And he had a fairly decent job, you know, middle class job. And he and his buddies would go hunting on the weekends, and they all had cars and campers, and they would be down in the alley washing their cars and campers and all that kind of thing. And then I had another good friend in the neighborhood whose father was a teacher, and his mom was a teacher. So, you know, so there were these models of success, even though no one was really wealthy by our standards at that time. But also South Shore did have, you know, its own element of wealth as well. There was a section of the neighborhood where a number of prominent people lived, including jazz musicians such as the pianist Ramsey Lewis. You would go to those areas, and these houses were quite lavish, you know. They were essentially small mansions, you know.
There was a lot of gun violence in Chicago in the 70s.
Yeah.
Is that something that touched your life?
You know, my mom actually carried a pistol, and there's a story behind that. So I don't remember exactly the year, but it must have been, it was either 73 or 74. My mom went out with a boyfriend, and they were returning home, and they were robbed at gunpoint in front of the building where we lived. And actually, the man that my mom was dating was a social worker. He was a college-educated man. And he had a fraternity ring or something of that sort that he didn't want to hand over. And my mom had to convince him to hand the ring over to the robber because the guy threatened to shoot him and my mom. And so after that incident happened, you know, my mom went out and she bought a pistol, you know. And
did she know how to shoot it?
She never took any classes, as far as I know. But, you know, in those days, we called it a Saturday night special. It was kind of these really cheaply produced guns that were primarily aimed at, primarily been promoted and sold in black communities across America. So my mom bought one of these Saturday night specials, you know, and she carried it every day, you know, for many years.
In a handbag or?
Well, what she would do is she would, in the morning, she would prepare it by putting it inside an ankle sock, and then she would put that in the pocket of her coat or in her purse. So one day my mom was preparing to go to work, and she was preparing her gun, putting it in the ankle sock, and she actually accidentally dropped it, and the gun hit the floor and discharged, and the bullet just barely missed me. So but, you know, it didn't deter my mom from carrying the gun. She still carried it, you know, because we lived in a decent neighborhood, but still crime was a reality in Chicago, and she was very fearful for that reason. So that was all in the early 70s, and it was really in the 80s when, once the crack epidemic took hold of Chicago and other cities in America, that gun violence became such a horrible thing, and which still persists even in Chicago to this day. You know, I always think of the 1980s as really this kind of apocalyptic moment in my own life, because all of a sudden, you know, we had this gun violence that we had never seen before. You know, people were being killed largely in matters related to drugs, and crack just did such other terrible things to the black community in terms of addiction and crime related to all that. I used to spend the weekends with my cousins, my first cousins, and that neighborhood where they lived became one of the worst areas of Chicago in terms of the murder rate and people killed, and it's still that way today. But that was a reality in Chicago, and you know, I think my mom was, you know, her life was really focused on doing everything she could so that I would have a better life than she did, in the same way that my grandmother, you know, made that sacrifice for my mom. So what happened is, when I was originally born in Chicago, we lived in this neighborhood that was directly parallel to University of Chicago. This is in 1962. The University of Chicago is in Hyde Park, very fine area, but the neighborhood where we lived was just literally across the street, you know, across, there was a divider. And that neighborhood where we lived was rife with violence even then. And my mom made the wise decision to move out of that area into South Shore. And that was in 1969 when I was seven. So she was aware enough to understand that she needed to leave that environment. But, you know, once the crack thing happened in the 80s, it was kind of impossible to get away from it in Chicago. And pretty much you know, my mom remained on the South Side in that neighborhood, but my cousins and others, they moved to other neighborhoods of Chicago to escape the violence, you know.
Did your mom give you advice on how to protect yourself as a young black man in Chicago?
Yeah, I mean, they were always kind of the dual threats of, on the one hand, of having to deal with gangsters and other criminals that made life difficult for everyone. And the other reality was, you know, how to deal with cops. Because, you know, there's been a lot recently in the media about cops killings in America. And there was this incident that drew such notoriety in Chicago of the killing of Laquan McDonald, which was caught in a video and, you know, and this kind of thing. That was all very shocking, and it should be shocking to many people. But, you know, that was kind of a reality that we knew. I mean, it was never captured on video when I was growing up. But in Chicago in particular, we all knew about the reality of cop violence. I mean, I saw cops beat up people, you know, with my own eyes. I mean, I was stopped by cops when I was 17 for no reason and essentially frisking in downtown Chicago in front of everyone for no reason whatsoever. And, you know, my older cousins had experiences with cops. And also Chicago had a very notorious police station where they would beat confessions out of people, where they would use electric shock. And that all came to light. So, I mean, you know, this has all been proven in studies. So one thing we knew in Chicago was that you had to conduct yourself around cops in a certain way. The idea was really to be polite and to even to be overly polite as much as you could, just so that you could survive the moment of the situation with the cop and just go on about your business. So, yeah, that was something that my mom taught me, and that was something that we heard other parents tell their kids, and that you had to know how to conduct yourself around a cop.
I can't help but hear echoes, Jeffrey, of you describing how your grandma in the South used to be extra polite, sort of subservient in front of the whites, and here in the North, in this place that's meant to be different, young black men having to behave in a similar way around white policemen.
Yeah, I mean, and I think that was, I've been really pondering writing a book about my mom because there's so much I've come to understand. But I think that was one of the big points of tension between my mother and myself. You know, people used to joke that we argue like husband and wife, you know. And I, you know, my view of my mom was that she was this person that allowed white people to step on her, basically. You know, in all honesty, that's how I saw it. And I felt that was a part of her having been raised in the South, and that was a part of her having been raised by my grandmother and so on. So that was sort of how you were expected to behave. But given that I was a Chicago kid and that I was an intellectual, or at least an intellectual in the making and that kind of stuff, I always wanted to be confrontational. And so I can remember, for example, when I was in college later, and once I was participating in a demonstration, and I said something, I basically said something offensive to a cop, and he arrested me. And that was the only time I've ever been arrested at this demonstration. And my mom's reaction was surprising. She was extremely angry. You know, she was like, "Oh, you know, why did you let those
angry
white
at you or at angry at the?"
She
cop.
Was angry. She wasn't angry at the cop. She was angry more at the protesters, the people who participated with me. And she's like, "You know, why did you let those white people get you in trouble or something?" So in her mind, it was really a question of how that would affect my education. You know, I was a college student at the time, and I saw it completely differently. I just couldn't understand why she wouldn't be angry about, you know, these political causes. But now when I think about my mom, I think she had a kind of survivor's mentality, you know, which is to say she obviously had seen these terrible things in the South, and she was not the person who wanted to pass those things on to me in terms of awareness. And she was the type of person who wanted to forget the past as much as possible. And the survivor's mentality is one where you try to avoid trouble and you try to do what you can to improve your situation, right? So I think a lot of young black people today aren't aware that cops will not be respectful to you simply because they should. There's an assumption and an expectation that a cop should be respectful, should honor your constitutional rights just because that's the way it should be. When, you know, the difference is growing up, we always knew that that wasn't a reality. I think that's part of the conversation around police violence. That's part of the conversation that's not really happening. Yeah.
This is Conversations on ABC Radio. Jeffrey, your latest novel is called The Song of the Shank, and it takes as its subject a real historic figure called Blind Tom. Who was he?
Yes, Blind Tom was a man. His real name was Thomas Green Wiggins. He was born a slave in Georgia in 1849. As far as we know, he was blind by birth, and he and members of his family were purchased by a man named General Thomas Bethune, who was an early secessionist for the South to leave the North, and essentially some of the things that led to the Civil War. I think the best way to describe Tom would be to say that he was a 19th century musical prodigy. So there's a lot of mythology about how he came to be a musician and how he started playing the piano. But the long and short of it is that he had this early ability to play, and he began giving concert recitals at age 6. He largely had a classical repertoire on the piano. And this is at a time where there are very few black people who are playing any kind of classical music. So Tom's notoriety and fame gained that so much that by the time he was 10, he played at the White House.
Wow.
He was the first African-American to ever play at the White House. And then his fame continued to grow, so much so that he played all around the United States. He played all across the UK, and he played all across Europe. Between essentially 1855 and into the late 1880s. And by the accounts of some people, he was the most popular pianist of the 19th century.
It's incredible. And yeah. A name that most people don't know
exactly.
Today, but this huge celebrity.
That's right. Yeah, that was the fascinating thing about his story. He had this tremendous popularity in his own time. And people like Ulysses Grant and Mark Twain and others wrote about him and talked about how amazing he was as a performer. So all of this was true, you know, and that I was amazed that he had disappeared, essentially, or he has disappeared from history. And I was also really just drawn by the descriptions of his musical performances. So as I mentioned, he had this classical repertoire, but he also had these other things that he did, which were kind of astounding. So he could, for example, he would do this thing where he played 3 songs at once.
How is that possible?
Well, he would play one song with his left hand in one key. He would play another song with his right hand in the second key, and then he would sing a third song in a third key.
Incredible.
Right. He would invite members of the audience to come up and play original compositions on the piano. And then he would, you know, replay them, reproduce them, and even improvise on them. And as well, he had his own compositions that he wrote, and some of them were in the tradition of the kind of music he played. So, you know, of Mozart or Chopin or Liszt and that kind of thing. But other compositions were based on man-made and natural phenomena in an effort to reproduce certain sounds on the piano. So, for example, one of his most popular tunes was one called Rainstorm, where he attempts to capture the sound of a rainstorm on the piano. Another very popular tune was called The Battle of Manassas, which was a song that celebrated the South's first victory in the Civil War. And in this particular song, he tries to capture all of the sounds of battle, you know, that kind of thing. And then in addition to all of that, he also had these other tremendous feats of memory where he would recite speeches, but also he could imitate the voices of other orators and all that. So, you know, it was a fascinating mix of things that he did, and it was all billed as the Blind Tom exhibition.
But it's superhuman powers, right, the way you're describing them.
Yeah, I think, in fact, many people felt that Tom was something otherworldly. So, you know, when people attended his concerts and, you know, they were coming in contact with this kind of a supernatural realm. I think there was a lot of that, yeah.
You say, Jeffrey, that he kind of disappeared from the historical record almost. How did you first find out about him?
It was really by accident. I was reading a book by the neurologist Oliver Sacks called An Anthropologist on Mars. Sacks talks about a fairly well-known savant, a guy named Stephen Wiltshire. Sacks mentions Blind Tom in a footnote, primarily as a way of talking about a historical, you know, precedent for Wiltshire.
Blind Tom was born in 1849 and died in 1908. So he lived through slavery, the Civil War, and then Reconstruction.
That's right.
So did you see Tom's story as an illustration of the sort of positive changes in African Americans' lives? Like, is this a trajectory from slavery into freedom?
I think it's a little more conflicting and complicated than that. You know, it's important to remember that Tom was owned by this General Bethune, who would have been a Confederate general if he had been of age to participate in the war, but he was a Confederate.
So in favor of the South, pro-slavery.
Exactly, yes. And so one of the dubious things that Tom had to do is to, during the war itself, he gave concerts that benefited the Confederate cause, essentially that, you know, raised money to keep slavery in place, which is what would have happened.
That's such a sad fact of his history.
Because Tom had that problematic political area of his life, Tom is not the poster child, really, for, you know, for integration, for racial progress, and those kinds of things. There was great admiration among African Americans in Tom's own era for him, despite whatever he had to do, this participating with the Confederates. But on the other hand, there was also, I believe, great embarrassment about him as well, and not just because he supported the Confederacy, but also because he was promoted as this idiot savant, this unintelligent, almost animal-like being. And so many black people found that embarrassing. I think if you look at Tom's life, I mean, his life didn't really change in practical terms, which is to say that, you know, even after slavery, when he was legally free, he was actually kind of re-enslaved legally as well. There was actually a court case where a judge decided that Tom should be put back into the legal custody of General Bethune because Tom was an idiot. And this is what the court ruled. And this is after the Civil War, and this is in the North in Cincinnati. So that's what that ruling said. And I think that ruling says so much about the failures of what happened in America after the Civil War. We of course, think of those 10 years after as the period of Reconstruction. And one of the goals of Reconstruction was to, for the first time, to bring equality and constitutional protection to African Americans in the South, who had essentially been denied all of that since they had been slaves. The unfortunate reality is that during Reconstruction, thousands of black people were murdered by mobs. This is the period when the Ku Klux Klan arose. And the Ku Klux Klan was America's first domestic terrorist organization, which it's important to remember. And then when Reconstruction was brought to a halt, essentially by the federal government withdrawing from the South and allowing the former slaveholders to do whatever they wanted.
So and entrenched segregation.
Yeah, exactly. So then we have the legalized segregation. So that's really the failure of American democracy at that moment. So Tom's life really, in that sense, kind of, I think, typifies what happened to black people throughout the 19th century and into the early part of the 20th century when he died in 1908. But here's a curious thing, too. When I first began to think about the ending of the novel, I thought it would be interesting to end the novel with the boxer Jack Johnson. As you may know, Jack Johnson was the first black heavyweight champion of the world in boxing. And interestingly enough, he came here to to Australia in 1908. The champion at the time was an Irish man named Tommy Burns, who, for the most part, avoided fighting Johnson. Then he decided to do it because essentially the promoter offered him so much money. So Johnson and Burns came here to Australia in 1908 for the championship
fight.
That's
where the championship fight was.
It was fought here in Australia. And Johnson, of course, beat Burns and won the championship. And what's interesting, though, about that in terms of the historical moment is that Blind Tom died in June of 1908, and Jack Johnson won the championship in December of that year. Sometimes Johnson is seen as being part of what's called the New Negro, this sort of new sense of a black pride that arose in the early decades of the 20th century. So I think it would be fair to say that, you know, Blind Tom came before all of that, and Jack Johnson represented something new.
I guess so. A parallel between them, Jeffrey, is, you know, African-Americans have such a significant place in popular culture and in sport, and this this realm of achievement is permissible, you know, from white America. And I wondered how you see parallels between Blind Tom as a musician and other African-American musicians that have come since him.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's twofold story. On the one hand, this whole practice of exploitation has continued certainly into the present, which is a way of saying being cheated is the oldest story in music. You know, like music was always kind of a shady industry, and with lots of people around who were looking to make money off of talent. Another way of thinking about it, though, is if you put aside this idea that Tom was a savant and you say, well, he was simply a musical prodigy, he was a genius, there is the question of that, of how does one reckon with the question of genius? And African-American genius has manifested itself in so many ways. And sometimes it's easy to write it off as just a natural ability, which is one of the reasons I wrote about Tom. Because there was some mythologizing around this idea that he had natural ability. He did have that, certainly, but in actuality, he also practiced, and he had trainers and teachers, you know, and so on. So, I mean, he put in a lot of hard work.
He had skill as well as just ability.
Yeah, and it's true that so much is talked about African-American musicians and African-American athletes, and but, you know, there are Black people make significant contributions in many other areas. I mean, we have a guy who's one of the people who runs NASA in America at the moment, and, you know, not to mention
the president.
Exactly. So there, I mean, and, you know, and there, and the Black story in America is not only one of poverty, but there is a diversity of experiences. One of the problems with America is that the narrative of Blackness is always one of limitation. And so these stories of success and these stories of diversity are not ones that are often presented to the public. Yes.
Jeffrey, you've been talking about, I guess, the influence that your mum had on you, on the influence that your mum's understanding of race had on the way that you saw yourself as a Black man in Chicago and beyond. You're a dad now yourself. You've got four kids. How old is your oldest of your children?
Yes, my oldest child is my son, Elijah. He is 15 and a half. He'll be 16 in December.
And so you're coming up, or you would have been for the last few years, I guess, wondering what to tell him about how to behave in a country where there is still huge problems with violence, all of the documented violence from police against young Black men. Where does that leave you? What are you giving your son the sort of advice you got from your mum, or are you telling him something different?
Yeah, I mean, there's an ongoing conversation. And I think this conversation really began to happen after the Trayvon Martin shooting a few years ago, and which is really when also the Black Lives Matter. Basically, this was a kid who was visiting his father in Florida and went out one night to buy candy or something and had a hoodie on, and this man, George Zimmerman, assumed that he was a criminal trying to break into an apartment, and they got into a confrontation, and then Zimmerman shot and killed him. I think that was a tremendously painful moment for all of us in America. You know, for I can remember so many conversations that I had with my friends about it, particularly with my black friends, and we were all outraged. And once the trial happened and Zimmerman was acquitted.
He was totally acquitted of the murder,
right, yeah. And, you know, what do you say to your kid after that? You know, that was sort of the moment when I really had to begin talking about the realities of race to my son. And, I mean, he had probably heard me mouth off and get angry 1,000 times before, but that was really the moment when I had to begin having the conversation. And I always say things to him which may be naive in certain ways, but, you know, if you're stopped by a cop or whatever the case may be, you know, you want to talk in such a way that shows that you're intelligent. That's really the most important thing. And often intelligence strikes fear in the other person. If you make this person aware that you know who you are and what your rights are under the law, and also, you know, tell them that your dad is a professor, you know, and a writer or whatever it would be. And so let me call my dad and that kind of thing. You know, again, a lot of this has to do with class, because so often the black people who are killed are basically poor black men, and they are killed because they are seen as disposable. This is not just race, but class really factors into that in this way.
It's interesting, Jeffrey, in this, from what you've been describing, the third generation in your family that's having this conversation about how to talk to white people who are potentially a threat to you.
Yes.
But unlike your mum and your grandma, rather than saying, keep yourself low, put yourself down, you're saying, show your smarts, show that you're powerful.
Right. Be polite, but also show your intelligence, right? And show that you have someone at your back, as we like to say in America, that someone has your back, and that's an important thing to know.
So although it's, you know, it's tragic and wrong that you're having to have this conversation in 2016, is there something positive perhaps in that you can advise your son to take that kind of response rather than the subservient response?
Yeah, I do think there's something positive, but again, you know, I think the foundations for that were set by my mom, and as I mentioned, her goal was always to be sure that I got a college education. And, you know, and top for a cliche, education is power. And and you know, I do think a lot of our troubles in America have to do with lack of education, and I don't mean just for black people or poor people, but the reality is that we have such a widespread level of ignorance in our country on the part of so many people.
I wondered if we could finish by reflecting, I suppose, on where your country is in this election year. But
yes,
before we get to that, I'd love to hear back about what it was like for you in 2008 when Barack Obama was first elected president.
Well, you know, I have to confess that my cynicism kind of got the best of me. I really didn't believe that he would win, even though all the statistics were saying something opposite. So it was a momentous occasion, you know, and we were all very hopeful then. And whatever Obama's limitations have been as a president, whatever his failures have been, he's also been one of our greatest presidents. And it was such a tremendous thing, not only because he was a black man, but also a black man who was intelligent and a reader who had written a book. And the Bush era was defined by so much hatred and brutality and ugliness. And so Obama was a lot of fresh air for so many different reasons. I do know a lot of people who've been disappointed with Obama, but I think that disappointment is probably justified. But at the same time, one of the realities of American politics is that the office of the president has its limitations, and Obama himself cannot, you know, he can't end years of institutional racism in America. You know, he himself cannot correct all the wrongs of America, and no president can, for that matter.
Where do you see then where your country is in terms of the election that's going to happen in November? Are you seeing a sort of reaction against not just the fact of a black president, but against a sort of president who embodied, you know, thoughtfulness and right, reflection and civility?
Yes, certainly. And I think one of the things that troubles me is that there's been such an apologetic attitude on the part of so many when it comes to Donald Trump, you know, and just these people who support him are not racist, they're not xenophobic, they're not misogynist or anything else. And when the reality is that those things are very much part of the American landscape and part of our political present, but also our political past and our history. And I think that what happened is with the rise of Donald Trump, he began to blatantly put forward a lot of the things that many people were thinking, which is unfortunate. And the truth of the matter is that, you know, America is such an anti-intellectual country for the most part. So if you're a person of any intelligence or understanding of the world in terms of books and things of that sort, you're seen as this elitist, and this term political correctness gets bandied around as a way of saying, oh, you know, I should be allowed to say anything I want to say. In fact, I believe Clint Eastwood made a statement about that. You know, he would like to be able to say racist and whatever else as they did in the old days. And, you know,
as his right as an American.
Right, exactly. There's this reactionary push against progress in America. That's one of the realities. And then you have this anti-intellectualism. You know, a large segment of our population is really poorly educated. And they are gullible to people like Donald Trump. And these are people who've been weaned for years on things like Fox News in America, where any kind of conspiracy theory is put forward and it's never challenged. And there are people who just buy into this stuff, you know. And I think that's a very troubling thing. It is true that our country is almost equally divided, you know, in certain attitudes. It's almost like the Civil War. Things are never changed, really, you know.
It is tragic that after these two terms of a president like Obama, that this is what America is potentially facing. It's not the future that would have been hoped after a presidency such as his.
It's really shocking, but at the same time, it's not shocking. But, you know, the fact that you get a person like Donald Trump, who is somehow seen as the person who will care about you and who will make America great again, as he likes to say, and how is it that people can come to buy into that kind of mythology? I mean, I think it's very troubling in what it says.
The speech that President Obama and Michelle Obama gave at the Democrat convention was so positive about that America doesn't need to be made great again, that their story is an example of the greatness America.
Yes.
Do you share that feeling?
I do. I mean, I'm proud to say that Michelle Obama is from working class roots in Chicago, you know, and as you know, President Obama himself did a lot of work in community activism in Chicago at a certain point. Yeah, and I think, again, that's the complexity of the American story. And but there's also this kind of exceptionalism, which is to say that I feel in some ways that my life has been very different from some of the people I grew up with. And I can't account for all of it, but part of it had to do with my mom. Part of it had to do with the fact that I was a reader, and that gave me a wider view of the world and gave me certain aspirations. But it shouldn't be that, you know, that shouldn't be the case. I mean, I think everyone should have access to education, and these are all kind of things that a good society should want for its people. So I just don't understand often some of the attitudes of my fellow American citizens. I don't understand what they're afraid of. You know, I don't understand the sources of the bigotry and hatred. I just don't understand where all of that is coming from. And then there are these people, you know, this really a small select group of elite people who exploit certain fears and hatreds for their own benefit, you know? So I'd hope as the people in the Black Lives Matter movement say, you have to stay woke, you know? So I would like to think that my fellow Americans will wake up and smell the coffee, you know.
Jeffrey, it's been fascinating talking to you. Thank you so much for coming on the Conversations.
It's been a pleasure being here. Thank you.
On ABC Radio, this is Conversations.
My guest today was Jeffrey Renard Allen. His novel about Blind Tom is called The Song of the Shank. Don't forget, all of our interviews are available on the website, abc.net.au/conversations. I'm Sarah Kanoski.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.